You're listening to the No BS Nutrition Podcast. I'm registered dietitian Hannah McGee.
And I'm neuroscience PhD student Tariq Youssef. And for the next hour, we're going to tackle popular nutrition topics from a scientific lens, promoting fact over fiction with no BS. Welcome back, everybody. It's our podcast. How do we do this?
Welcome back, everyone, to the No BS Nutrition Podcast.
Okay.
I'm registered dietitian Hannah McGee.
And I'm neuroscience PhD student Tariq Youssef. And this is No BS Nutrition. Did you already say that?
I said, welcome back to the No BS Nutrition Podcast. But
oh, that's really good. I'm waving to our imaginary producer. Keep that all in. It's really funny. Some people will like that.
Yeah, we'll leave it in. We don't care. Yeah, we're real. Exactly.
We're real. And we're here to talk about some real things with people. Hannah and I, off pod, were just discussing something that I haven't done in a really long time. We were discussing vacation plans, which feels weird because that part of my life felt like it was never going to happen again for a while.
I know. It's been rough the last year. I guess last year we had the travel bubble here in Atlanta, Canada.
That's true. We got to see each other for Christmas, which I think we were a lot luckier than a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. But still, I feel like the last few months out here in Atlanta, Canada, has been a little bit rough in terms of travel and things like that, even like interprovincially. So we're looking forward to, we're going on vacation together.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
I guess just a few weeks. Well, when this episode airs, it will be like in like a week.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh, live stories of us cooking together. Cannot wait.
Yeah. So it's going to be, it's going to be a good time. We're looking forward to it. Spending lots of time in person. I haven't seen you yet since Christmas, which is just, oh gosh, that's mind-boggling.
It's unbelievable.
But I'm looking forward to it. Anyways, I shouldn't take up too much time. I want to hear what you have for me today.
Well, Hannah, and listeners, dear friends, I have something that I hope everybody finds interesting. Hannah, do you know why we eat almonds on planes?
On planes?
Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of synonymous with planes, right? Almonds and pretzels, that's kind of like synonymous with travel, with plane travel.
Yeah,
don't you
like
think?
the little packets of them.
Exactly.
Do you even know on some planes they give, like, are you saying like the ones that they give out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know why. I'd love to know.
Okay. Well, some people might think it's because almonds are a superfood, whatever that means, which we'll get into.
Right.
But after we have our conversation today, I think maybe the curtain will be peeled back on why we eat almonds on planes and what we think about almonds in general and maybe superfoods in general.
I'm very interested. So this
was a really interesting paper, and again, it was one paper, but I thought it was very thorough. Excited for people to read it. If they're interested, link in the description as usual. Okay, so this paper is by, I think her name was Emily Reisman. Is that right? Emily, yes, it is Emily Reisman.
Emily, are you
from
there?
University
of
California. Are you there? From University of California, Santa Cruz. This paper is from 2019, not that long ago, and it's called Superfood as Spatial Fix, The Ascent of the Almond. So I want to give a little bit of a background here. So basically what we're getting into is that the almond status as a superfood, again, whatever that means, we'll get into it, can be really closely tracked to its production. So I'm kind of going to spill the beans up front, and then we're going to talk about it together. So basically, almond production, as it surges, then the almond industry has to constantly work with those surges in order to change the way that consumers see almonds, you know, and the way that they even see themselves as consumers. Mm-hmm. It gets really interesting. So the food industry can have a really strong influence on the food market and then therefore can have a strong influence on the consumer. And this can be extrapolated to other foods, not just almonds. So we're kind of like, as we're going to talk today, we're going to peel back the curtain on how agrarian or agricultural capitalism drives our food choices at large. So many superfoods or foods that are termed superfoods carry kind of like, I guess, like an exotic appeal, like tropical fruits. They're marketed as foods that have been like, quote unquote, discovered like by North Americans as part. Like, we're like, we found like this tropical fruit that an indigenous nation eats in Fiji. And like it they've been using it for millennia. Like this must be a superfood. Like it kind of has this like mystical definition. This happened in South America with quinoa, the acai berry in the Amazon, argan oil in Morocco, which like beyond food is now like into cosmetics, right? Mm-hmm. And actually almonds are frequently found in cosmetics as well, which again, there's lots of reasons for that we're going to get into. So there's also locally grown foods that can have a superfood title, you know, almonds, North America anyway, blueberries, broccoli, cranberries, spinach, kale, that's a great one. You know, and this paper that I'm going to be talking about argues that almonds have risen to superfood status by the effort of the almond industry in order, and this is the big, like, in bold letters on the billboard, in order to keep up with overproduction. So basically, as the almond industry has grown, there have like literally like there are more acres of almond plants. Basically, the almond industry has chosen to do things in order to drive sales of almonds, to keep up with how much they're producing. And a lot of that has really been funding nutrition science that then allows them to kind of embellish labeling on their foodstuffs, on whatever thing has almonds in it that they're producing, in order to justify advertising almonds as a healthy food. Because there are regulations, obviously, with what you can say about how healthy something is on a food, which is why they end up funding this nutrition science that we're going to be talking about. And all of this obviously is because they want to avoid a price crash, because if there's just like too many almonds and nobody's buying them, then they have to drive prices down. Right. Mm-hmm. But they want to keep prices up. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, you know, over time, American food habits have been changing. Right. So over time, we're interested in, like, in general, I'm not talking about us, but like in general, society has been more interested in like more protein consumption and actually more snacking, which has also helped the almond industry grow a lot. And regular health messages like this has protein, even that has like kind of been getting old. And this paper argues that that's where like the superfood status kind of jumps in. This like weird mystical thing that you almost like even can't quite pinpoint, but these foods that make us better, these superfoods. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that a bit more too. Basically, let's have a little bit of an economics lesson, I guess, if that's okay with everybody. I was shocked to even write this down, but we're doing it. So there was this nice quote that I wanted to share. So to avoid painful devaluation that comes with overproduction, the ever unstable accumulation of surplus capital buys itself time through market expansion. So basically, when there's overproduction, you want to expand your market. One of the interesting things I learned about food is actually there's a law in food economics that people can only spend so much on food. And part of that is literally like physically, we can only eat so much.
Right.
So it's hard to make one person eat more almonds. So it's difficult to like advertise to people who love almonds. Mm-hmm. You need more almonds, even though you already eat them.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you want to market to different kinds of people. And there's actually a law called Engel's Law that says, that kind of proves this, that as wealth increases, people still spend the same portion on food. So even if you make more money, you're not buying more food. I mean, you literally can only physically eat so much again, right?
True.
So this is the struggle that the almond industry has as its production has increased. So superfoods then. Let's talk a little bit about superfoods. Okay. So more than anything, I guess, not to bury, I don't want to bury the lead, like it's just hype. Like a lot of it is just hype. And perceived benefit rather than actual nutrition science, right? So there's definitely, like, I think we've talked about this before, like functional foods, like foods that have like essential nutrients, or like beyond just essential nutrients, where maybe at certain levels when they're eaten are kind of tied to or linked to scientifically some sort of benefit, like whether it's omega-3 fatty acids, right, or things like that reduce LDL cholesterol, reducing risk of heart disease. There are things like that. There are, like, quote, functional foods, but superfoods have, it kind of, they kind of suggest this, like, intangible experience is the words that the paper used, this experience of vitality, high spirits, basically like a glow up, like just like overall wellness, right? Yeah. Superfoods. And this one item can do so many things, right? Like it's almost like this food has limitless benefits. Like I've seen it a lot with like pomegranates, right? Like this food has just so much in it. Like, and it's almost like just like not described. It's like, this is the best food for you to live. Like some of it can even be that vague, right? Mm-hmm. Part of that is also, you know, that goes along with an emphasis on whole foods in our society. And again, that whole thing of like, they want to tease at the sort of like historical or cultural phenomena that like this food is like tied to like generational wisdom. Like kimchi has been made for like hundreds of thousands of years, like underground, being fermented, like picking the cabbage with your own hands, you know what I mean? Like there's like this weird like they want to like put you in, they want you to connect to the story and like be part of something bigger than yourself with a superfood. And this has been used like as a marketing tool, right?
Definitely.
And something that, you know, scientific research has mostly been funded by scientific research on foods like this, like whole foods that are like driving this superfood concept, has mostly been funded by industry. I mean, typically nutrition scientists are like, they really want to focus on something specific, like let's look at a specific nutrient, or like let's look at the effect of this food on like a protein or some sort of like pathway, rather than like we're the I don't know, the broccoli lab. That's not really like a thing. Like maybe in like generally that can, like sometimes there are labs that are dedicated to studying apples, for example, but they're really dedicated to studying like I don't know, like apple maturation, or the amount, like how apples fend off pests or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like whatever, like the almond lab. Like, that's not really a thing. That's driven by the food industry rather than actual scientists.
Right.
And actual scientists very frequently struggle getting money. So they end up, you know, partnering up with these industries and in like throughout history, this has kind of benefited the whole superfood phenomena.
Right.
And interestingly, I saw the European Union ban the use of superfood on a food product in 2007, unless it was accompanied by what they say is an authorized health claim. And I'm sure there's lots of loopholes there.
Yeah, anyway. That's so interesting because I mean, you see it all the time on food labels in the grocery store. Like, if you go into, like, the, I don't know, the health food section of the grocery store, you'll see on so many labels, like, made with 8 different superfoods or, like, things like that on the label. And what gets me, and I think that's kind of interesting why they banned it, or banned the use of the term, is because there's really no definite, like, you know, definition of superfood. It's not a term that's actually been defined. You know, like a food has to contain this much of something to be considered a superfood or have this actual benefit to be a superfood.
There's no scientific definition. Like the word is in the dictionary, but there's no scientific, like whatever, like qualifications.
Yeah, exactly.
Requirements.
Yeah. So it's just so interesting to me how, the term has really kind of exploded, I guess, in the last probably 10 years or so. And there's really no definition. It's kind of like clean eating too. You know, there's no definition of what that actually is, like what it excludes and what it includes. So really you could call a superfood anything. So, you know, some people might call a superfood some, you know, some like powder or supplement powder, you know what I mean? Like they'd call that a superfood. And then other people would look at like blueberries or pomegranates, like you're saying, and call that a superfood. So it gets confusing too. Like what constitutes a superfood? Because there's no real definition.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned like how that's really like been a recent thing, like in like historical, like in the food market. But because that has also gone hand in hand with how us as consumers, how we have changed. And we are, I mean, so obviously, like we're more and more obsessed with our own bodies. We're more and more obsessed with how we control our own bodies and our relationships with food and how food affects our bodies. Like everybody wants to make like, not everybody, but a lot, it's becoming more popular to make very specific choices in order to very specifically then control our own body. And that has also gone along with an increase in advertising. So like, people in general, like overall, I'm not just talking about food, like we are bombarded with more advertising than ever now. Because even though none of us watch TV anymore, we're getting ads on Instagram and on Facebook and on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like YouTube, like we're just getting bombarded with advertisements. Yeah. And whether or not a food is, let's say, unhealthy, like quote unquote unhealthy, whether or not a food is like ultra processed, there can still be an economic reason to drive its promotion. Like even though, yes, like almonds are, you know, a very low processed food at most, they're probably shelled. If they're processed a bit more, they're probably like roasted and salted. Even though like that might be quote unquote healthier to some people than let's say like pop or soda, there are still industries behind those foods promoting them regardless of their nutritional value, right? So even though it's less controversial, let's say, to promote almonds than pop or soda, I think, like I was even, as I was reading this, I was like, it was almost for me, I was like, it's just on a commercial. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, someone wants to make a profit off of this.
Yeah.
And this is what we're going to dive into now. And I'll try to do this quickly. So the almond timeline. So I didn't know this, but this was really, this was interesting for me to find out. In the 1900s, almonds were, they were kind of like a treat. And you really would only have them in the winter months. They were harvested in late August, processed in October and November, and then that's, you would have them as like a holiday thing, like you would eat them like around the fire, you know what I mean, like with Christmas, kind of like roasting chestnuts, like that kind of thing. And it really was like, it just followed that like seasonal cycle. People didn't really eat almonds like throughout the year. That was not a thing in North America. But cultivation grew, people wanted a piece of the almond profit, popularity among farmers grew as well, and this kind of clashed with the seasonal niche because there started becoming too many almonds for the first time to only sell them for a few months out of the year.
Right.
Okay. So eventually, actually, the farmers, is California is one of the only places in North America that's really feasible to grow almonds.
Yeah.
And eventually all of the, like, I guess most of the farmers in California who grew almonds kind of banded together and they created this coalition. And they would sell in a unified manner. So they would set their prices, and that's how all of the growers would sell. so that they weren't really competing with each other and they could keep prices high. And this worked for them, you know? And because they had a monopoly too, like people weren't growing almonds on the East Coast and people weren't growing almonds up north because the land just wasn't right for them. The climate wasn't right for them. So this worked for them again until for the second time, there were too many almonds because there were more farmers making more almonds. Cultivation was growing. So they're getting worried about a crash again. So basically, this is the first time that the coalition of almond growers in California in the early 1900s sent out a pamphlet, a booklet to its growers, its members, saying that we need to increase, we need to fund advertising in order to increase demands. We need new markets to sell to because we can't stay stuck in this like semi-seasonal cycle. So to increase demand, they tried to shift the patterns of consumer consumption of almonds. People, consumers just thought like, it's like ridiculous. Like, it's just like not part of our culture to eat almonds anytime other than Christmas and New Year's. So the meaning of what like an almond was to a consumer had to completely change. So they were making advertisements trying to sell people on the idea that almonds weren't just a, you know, they're not just an appetizer or a rare delicacy, but they're something that you should always keep in your house. So that was kind of the theme of the first set of advertisements that really hit nationally in the States anyway, really hit consumers hard. So it's kind of weird to think like, even though we think of them as a superfood today, like about a century ago, it was like super, it was like unthinkable even for someone to eat almonds outside of the holidays.
Right.
So in the 1960s, 40 years of marketing had gone by the almond industry, and they finally were able to convince the consumer base to shift to year-round buying. They actually ended up in the 1920s successfully lobbying to raise tariffs on almond imports from Europe. So basically making it so that they still maintain the monopoly on almonds in America. Again, keeping prices up for them and lessening the competition they had with anybody else.
Right.
This like coalition of farmers in California. They're expanding their market, which means more growers are coming in. So again, even though they're expanding their market, they're still scared of overproduction. They eventually, for the first time, the Almond Growers Exchange in California contracted with a private firm in order to work on, for the first time, this was like state of the art, nutrition analysis of the almond. These people were not working closely with, let's say, like hospitals or like local researchers to whatever promote nutrition health. They were working directly with advertisers. So they want to get these nutrition stories about almonds into newspapers, radio stations, magazines, into school curriculum. And they were working with dietitians, other like health professionals. They even contacted, you know, the Army, the Navy, and the Marines trying to promote almonds as this like nutritious food stuff that everybody needed to be eating. And then came World War II. Okay, so they had all this research already. The nutrition data talking about how calorically dense almonds are. You know, they give you lots of energy. They have lots of fats. So they eventually successfully, the Almond Growers Exchange of California successfully lobbied the government to designate almonds as an essential food in order to make sure that basically like every soldier in World War II had almonds with them. So again, making sure that whatever way possible, they could continue increasing production, but at the same time, avoiding a crash by making sure they had more markets to buy their almonds. It's the extent to which they went, it has nothing to do with like making food and wanting to feed people. Like it so much has to do with like maintaining these profits. And then, you know, that another obstacle came in 1945. President Truman reversed some of the foreign tariffs on foods, meaning that almonds could be easily imported again. So they had all these, now the California growers were head to head with the Europeans again, trying to sell almonds to the States. But so what would they do now? Then they secured a purchasing agreement with the school lunch programs in the U.S. to buy 5 million pounds of almonds a year. So again, making almonds such a fundamental part of the masses, basically like every child was getting almonds at school, tried expanding the market to lots of new consumer bases. They were trying to feature almonds in women's magazines. They made almonds the standard airline in-flight snack. This was one of the things they did. Right. They deployed almonds to, you know, dress up frozen dinners. They were reaching out to everybody, basically, to sell their almonds. And again, more people wanted in on the almond business. So it's just like cyclical yeah. thing, right? This is what also eventually led to things like, you know, almond milk becoming so popular. Because, again, they're trying to diversify their market. It wasn't necessarily about providing an alternative for vegans. That really didn't have anything to do with it. It was like, how can we use all the almonds we're making in order to keep making more money? They even did things like, this is something that other food industries have been accused of before, like basically hoarding almonds, not putting them out into the market in order to maintain prices,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So many things. So I promise now I'm getting near the end. And now we're going to talk about almonds' health halo. So it was kind of like in the 1970s. We've talked about this before. Health halo is like a product appears healthier to consumers because it contains an ingredient that people like recognize as healthy. And people buy that product because they think, oh, this foodstuff must be healthy because, it's gluten-free or something.
Yeah.
Like gluten-free
yeah.
has a health halo. I think that being gluten-free is healthy, so I'm going to buy these gluten-free crackers. So healthy kind of began popping up in almond advertisements around the 70s because it was then that society was kind of moving towards this like whole like natural like whole foods sort of thing.
Okay.
In the 1990s, the almond industry would begin a lot more nutrition research in order to back up lots of new promotional claims about, you know, because that was when the low-fat diet craze was like all happening.
That's what I was going to ask about, like if there was anything in there about how they like dealt with the low fat craze, because
exactly.
obviously almonds have some fat in them. So, yeah.
So this new nutritional research that was funded in the 90s was all about categorizing almonds as quote unquote good fats.
Mm.
This is where like the good versus bad fat
yeah.
thing actually came from. Like wow. almonds, the almond industry was kind of this like weird trailblazer in like brainwashing all of us in terms of wellness culture. So about basically like 75% of like the existing worldwide knowledge about almonds basically comes from the California Almond Exchange, and how they eventually grew into what then became like a government office and like successfully were like lobbying the government in order to permit them to do things that were like new for the very first time, like this kind of like crazy like federal onslaught of campaigns
right.
and the funding of nutrition research to like a really like unbelievable extent for the first time. They actually eventually ended up petitioning the FDA for a claim that says scientific evidence suggests but does not prove that eating 1.5 ounces of most nuts per day as part of a diet low in saturated fat and cholesterol may reduce the risk of heart disease. And like you said, they worked really hard for that, but even still, other organizations were gatekeeping them. Like the American Heart Association didn't like how much fat was in almonds. But eventually, because of this whole like good fat thing, they were able to petition to the American Heart Association to give them, I don't know if you know, like, you know that check? It's like the AHA, and then there's like a red check or something.
Yeah.
It's like the heart health check. That's how they ended up getting that. It's like through years of nutrition research to end up lobbying these organizations in order for them to be able to use nutrition labeling that would drive consumers to buy their products. It was like, then of course, like, again, they need to continue growing their markets. This is when the superfood thing started happening. Late 90s, early 2000s, the almond industry began funding research on cognitive performance, on skin health, wrinkle prevention, optimizing gut function, because they wanted to sell almonds to a new kind of person. the early 2000s was, I don't know if you remember all of those yogurt commercials where, like, it was basically, like, all women, like, in the office trying to, like, multitask and do a million things. It's a lot of it is, like, marketing that's done towards women who are like, trying to get as much done as possible.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And, like, that reminds me of, like, the like, cereal commercials marketed to women, too. Like, all the Special K and things like that. Yeah.
Absolutely. So the almond industry was following these findings that over the years, generations have rated that they have higher and higher stress. So they want to be selling to people with hectic lifestyles. So here's a quote. Almond advertisers want potential consumers to think of almonds as not just the best snack choice, but the snack that would give them the energy to keep powering through. They want people to think that almonds were this, like, weird, like, nutritional powerhouse. In 2018, they embraced the term superfood for the first time, actually, on their by adopting the slogan Blue Diamond. Basically, that is the California growers, yep, almond growers exchange. That became Blue Diamond. They started using the slogan, "Don't deny your cravings, eat them. All the flavors you crave in a superfood." They want to attract new almond eaters, make them eat more almonds than they were already eating, trying their best to do that. And they wanted to frame this using this, like, newfound idea of a superfood to basically drive sales through predominantly female eaters, that they're making healthy choices that are going to, it's almost like magical. Like, you're making a choice that's going to magically allow you to, like, get through your day, like, get on all of those, like, conference calls and drop the kids off at school, pick them back up. You know what I mean? Like, that is the consumer they want to drive. And that is why we eat almonds on planes.
Wow.
Did any of that make sense?
It made total sense. And it was actually, like, really, really interesting to learn.
Thank you.
I'm curious, though. So, you know, as a dietitian, I was trained in nutrition and learned about, you know, the nutrition value and facts of all sorts of different foods. And so, like, I mean, I still would view almonds as, like, a nutritious food.
Absolutely.
But it's just interesting to hear how they became known as that. Like, they always were, but they, like, initially when, like you mentioned how it was kind of a seasonal thing around the holidays, they weren't consumed as a health food. They weren't, even though they were still nutritious. But it's just interesting.
And it's not like the science came first and drove eating habits.
Right. Yeah.
The producers wanted to drive consumption, so they went and made science, basically.
Yeah, like found.
Not that it's untrue that there is protein there. But again, you're describing it as, like, a normal person would. Like, almonds, sure, like, maybe they're a functional food. Like, yes, they are calorie dense, and, like, that might help somebody who, like, needs to snack or something. But they're not this, like, superfood that's, you know, gonna do this, like, magical thing and, like, dramatically change your life, give you excess energy more than anything else.
Totally. Yeah, I agree.
So that is basically kind of like a BS of the week on superfoods in general, and a little bit that made me think of, like, in general, just, like, food advertising beyond, it made me think about how I interpret what I believe to be healthy or unhealthy foods in food advertising, and like what the intention actually is behind that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could talk about this at length in terms of milk, because the milk industry does a lot of advertising. The beef industry does a lot of advertising. Turkey farmers are doing more and more advertising as of late. There's a lot of this going on, right? So it was very interesting for me to read all this.
Yeah, that's really, really neat. Thank you so much for digging into that and for sharing it, because that was really, really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, now I guess we know more about, you know, almonds and how they rose to their, I guess, popularity today, because they, mm-hmm. I would say they're definitely like viewed as a health food and like a, even we don't have to get into this, but like the between like almond butter and peanut butter, you know,
yes.
I feel like people view almond butter as this like more like, yeah. it's like cleaner, healthier food, even though
totally,
you know, if it's a natural almond butter and natural peanut butter, that's basically like, you know, the same thing.
And almost that like societally nuts have kind of become a staple, like bar nuts, like yeah. having nuts at home as like an appetizer for or a snack for yeah. people.
Trail mix.
That's something that like took basically like 100+ years of advertising money in order to influence our purchasing patterns.
Wow.
And make almonds what they are today.
Yeah. Wow. That blows my mind. Like that our purchasing patterns are like mm-hmm. a result of years, like a century of
yeah.
Like marketing efforts and things like that.
And there was so much more I wish we had time to get into, but it's even things like lobbying supermarkets to buy shelves, like paying supermarkets to buy up shelves to have interesting displays to really promote these things, right? Like it does get kind of like freaky. Like if I think about my pantry and think like, okay, why did I buy this? Like, did I buy it because I like it, or there was a sign, or like did someone 100 years ago start making like using advertising money in order to get this into my cupboard? Yeah.
Well, there you go, everyone. I mean, that's a little peek inside of what goes on, I guess, sometimes in the food industry. So anyways, I thought that was really, really interesting. That was great.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening. I invite you to go have an existential crisis by opening up your fridge and thinking about what may or may not been might not have been a subconscious or conscious decision in terms of purchasing. And I also invite you to come back on Friday and listen to our second episode this week.
Yeah.
I'm really, really excited to have that conversation with you, Hannah.
I'm looking forward to it as well. So everyone, make sure that you rate the podcast, leave a review, and subscribe. And don't forget to follow us on our socials. We will link them in the description. And I guess we'll talk to you guys.
Please subscribe.
We'll talk to you guys on Friday.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.